Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. My co-host is Bill McHenry. Bill, how are you today?
Absolutely terrific, Ron.
That's great. Well, Bill, you know, on Launch, we focus on the launching of a business, both, you know, before the launch and during the launch and after the launch, so that our listeners can successfully navigate their launch. This morning, we're going to be we're featuring Thomas Kershaw of Ballback Incorporated. But before we get started, Bill, could you thank today's sponsor?
I will, Ron. Today, our sponsor is Patents and More. Patents and More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
All right. Well, thanks. Well, Bill, why don't you introduce our guest?
Well, I will, Ron. Tom Kershaw is our guest today. And Tom sold a successful contracting engineering firm. It was actually a machine and tool design firm in upstate New York before, as he states it, fleeing to Florida to chase other inventive ideas and profitable products. Today he's called the Inventor in Paradise. In fact, that's his website, inventorinparadise.com. He has multiple patents, Ron. He also has products and a claim to fame for inventing the popular basketball return. Ron, he's also VP of the Edison Inventors Association in Fort Myers, Florida, and author of a book called Inventor in Paradise, which I have actually read, Ron, and it's a terrific book.
That sounds super.
Tom is also a mentor through his website that he calls inventor-entrepreneur.com. He shares a lot of hints, tricks, and horror stories he's learned over the years by pursuing profitable products.
Well, that's cool. Tom, you know, I spoke down there at that club. Did I meet you when I was down there?
You certainly did. In fact, we went to lunch afterwards, remember?
Oh, now it's all coming back to me. You know, the older I get, the short-term memory starts to fade, you know.
Well, you were busy talking about your grandkids most of the time, you know.
That's true. But, yeah, I do remember you now. That was super. That was great meeting with you down there.
So we appreciate you showing up. It was one of our better speakers. What I'd like to talk to about today is about the development of the basketball return.
Yeah, sounds good.
That's great. Tell us how you came about the idea and a little history on it.
Well, I was born and lived near Syracuse, New York. And, you know, that's home of snow, cold, asthma, and the Carrier Dome. The Carrier Dome is where the Big Orange play. You have to have a pair of binoculars when you go to the game. It's so big there. But everybody in our area grows up with a basketball. Well, I was 5'11", kind of stuck to the ground, didn't know what it was like to touch the rim, you know, in reality, unless I got a snowbank I could jump off of. But I shot free throws, and continually the ball would bounce away. It'd go through the rim, down the net, hit the edge of the court, and careen down a hill into a pond. I'd go down there after the ball. I'd slip and fall in the pond, step in the muck on the shoreline, and kept dreaming there had to be a way to get the ball back to the shooter. You know, if you stand there and shoot free throws and you make the shot, don't you think you'd get a reward of a return ball instead of going after it? So, with my inventive prowess, you know, I thought then of lesson number one for an inventor. You stay at home and you discover what's obvious to you. We're not talking rocket science here. We're talking getting a ball to come back to you when you shoot at the hoop. And this is what I preach to my novice inventors that show up at the meeting all the time. You know, I'm always argued that contractors, electricians, plumbers, these people come up with the ingenious tool ideas, the little gimmicks. And the reason they do is they're overcoming a fault or failure they've got in their profession, something that's hazardous to them or too time-consuming, and they come up with the gimmicks. It's the things that are underneath your nose that end up being the best inventions. That's what I thought, and that's how I sat down and looked at the ball and the basket, and I said, I got to discover a way to do it. And there were a few challenges along the way. Design challenges particularly. At one time, I had 9 rims hanging in the cellar of my home. 9 of them. I found them along the road on trash day. I went to the stores and bought them. I couldn't believe the variety of rims. All of them had a basic 5-inch wide plate and 4 mounting holes, and they were pretty consistent that way because they had to fit all of the backboards that are on the market. And the backboards come, some are acrylic, fiberglass, plastic, they're wood. In Indiana, they put rims on the side of a barn. But those rims are consistent in that shape and size. I don't think there's necessarily a detailed drawing of a standard basketball rim. You know it has to be 18 inches on the inside diameter, and it has to have 10 randomly placed, usual, randomly placed net hooks. There's 10 loops on a net. They have to be hooked to the rim somehow. Today, you've got buttons and plastic connectors, and you got woven things. Yesteryear, it was always the little spiral piece of metal that was twisted and welded. And because they were rims were manufactured by little shops, there was no real standard. You couldn't rely on those weldments being postured a certain degrees away. Then you always get the comments of kids who say they can fit 2 balls through a rim at a time. You know, you really, ideally, you can't. The difficulty is there's a bunch of ball sizes. Balls vary from, if it's professional, and from high school on up, professional, a ball is measured, you'll love this, it's measured by its circumference. Remember trigonometry?
2 pi r. Yeah, no, I don't.
2 pi r, right? 2 pi r equals the circumference. A 29-30-inch circumference ball figures out ideally at 9.39 inches in diameter. So there's the answer. You put 2 of them side by side, and there's no way they're going to fit through an 18-inch hole unless you compress the ball and push them through. So that's one wives' tale that we just omitted. But I had to consider, on the rims, they have so many gussets, so many different angles and brackets extending from the mounting plate up to the rim. Some have fins hanging behind the rim or downward, kind of artistically designed. Some rims are welded one on top of the other, double rims. You see them a lot at the outdoor yards where they use steel chain nets. So there's a lot of things to consider on how you were going to put a device up there. I wanted something, one piece, simple to snap over the rim, hang freely, swing and kick the ball back center court, free throw area, back on the court to the player. You didn't want something complicated. You didn't want to get out with a ladder all the time and fix it. You're sure as the Dickens didn't want to try to get Dad off the couch to come out there to do something. You wanted something simplistic, as usual. Simple is better. So I felt I had to have something. I had to get some material and be able to bend it around to create some type of a shape that would hang from the rim, circumvent the net area, and still reach down below the hole of the net to act as a paddle if a high trajectory ball came towards the goal and came straight down through. It would still come in contact with the device and kick that ball forward towards the free throw line. Wow. That sounds simple.
Jeez.
It sounds simple. How do you find a material to do that? You know, I went and got coat hangers, and because I could bend them in my hand and get different shapes to feed up in the area of the rims. I'm walking up and down the different ones. I'm on the bread at eye level so I could get at them easily. And I'm trying to get that shape to fit up in the brackets and hang. And as I got close to something, then I advanced and used soft copper, like plumbing copper. You can buy it in 3/8 diameter. You can bend it over your knee or with your hand, heat it with a torch. You can bend it pretty readily. You can solder it together. It's a good fabric for fiddling with. It isn't the answer. You're certainly not going to make a ball return out of copper. but it gives you the liberty of trying things, feeding in the size, the shape, and having it evolve. What I finally did was I found PVC rod, polyvinyl chloride. And a firm in Rochester, New York, a big warehouse up there, had PVC rod in 9-foot lengths, half-inch diameter, 9-foot long. So I thought, you know, if I can't make the product with 9 feet of material, you know, that should be enough to be able to bend around and shape. And PVC is a great material for an inventor to fiddle with because you can heat it with a hot air gun or your wife's hair dryer, anything infrared, it's very susceptible to that type of heat. You can gently warm it, wear gloves. It does get hot, and it'll start getting a little wet, like on the surface, when it's about ready to reach its temperature. And when it reaches that temperature, you can bend it, gentle, hold it. It's going to have a memory. It wants to come back to its original shape. It's going to try to straighten out again. You've got to hold it till it chills. But you can take that piece of material, PVC particularly, you can weld it with virgin material. All you got to do is buy a hot air welding device. That's all it does. It just heats the virgin material together and bonds it. And that weld is as strong as what the rod itself is. But besides welding it, when you get into fabricating, PVC is extrudable and it's injection moldable. So you've got a whole realm of industry you can attack when you develop your product. Now, I discovered this by going to stores that sold PVC furniture and found out the polymers and suppliers who sold them the raw materials or the injection. And some of these furnishings, you'd look at a chair, yes, you know some are glued together, but others have fancy webbed rattan designed panels in them. You look closely, they're welded in place, and they were obviously extruded. Some things were stamped. There is all types of fabrication available from that material. So I fell in love with the PVC. I thought that was great for an inventor to take and nurse it along to any product he was developing. It may not be the final material in production. It may not be the least expensive. In fact, in reality, when it comes to manufacturing, PVC is it's not the most environmental friendly material, and sometimes you're going to end up paying a penalty at the factory because they have to have reclamation hoods. They have to capture the odors. Your burden for that machine, the hourly rate of that machine, will be higher than the machine next to it that doesn't have that problem, that might be running a safer, more friendly material.
Well, Tom,
when I listen to all this and think about all the work you've done and all the analysis, how did you learn all this? Was it trial and error, or is there something you can tell our listeners that would help them understand what they need to do to be as good at it as you are?
Well, you know, I had a huge benefit by having my own engineering firm for 22 years, and I did random contractual engineering. I never really knew what I was going to be hired to do. We built a printing press so big, it took us 2 years to design and build it. It was so large, we put it on 2 railroad cars and shipped it to Washington, D.C. And today it prints stocks and bonds. Now, you're not going to build too many printing presses in your lifetime. A little while later, a firm called me, and they wanted me to make a machine to make garbage bags. Now, how the hell many times is someone going to ask you to make a machine to make a garbage bag? And how do you know how to do that? Well, I went to a plant that made garbage bags, and I moved my drawing boards in there, and I copied every darn thing I could and talked to them about improvements and worked it out, and we built a better machine. Now, what I'm trying to get at is inventing is the same thing. You're not born with any intuitive knowledge of this. You have to go out and steal thoughts from other people, find out the process they went through, get all the stumbles they made, and try to avoid them. And that's exactly what mentoring an inventor at our at Edison Inventors Association, that's exactly the process. You go there and join a club to get the benefit of others who have fought all the hurdles and falling in all the pitfalls and had all the dangers and faced all the scammers. Well, you need guidance. So,
and you really can't do it all yourself.
There's no way. There's no way you can even guess at it. And I've never gone in all those years of contractual engineering, I never went into any job anywhere and told somebody I knew what I was doing. I certainly didn't want to give them any pretense that I was smarter than they were or that I knew more about their business than they do. There's no way. You go in there and just say, I'm going to do all I can, I'm going to grab all the information I can from you, and I'm going to ask you to help me all you can.
Sure.
And that's what works, you know.
Well, Tom, you know, how did you actually test the concept of the ball back?
When I got the shape in my mind that worked the best, by using the PVC, I was able to create some type of a shape that looks like a butterfly from the distance. You have two huge wings above and a tailpiece wing, and consider it almost like the fuselage of an airplane with two wings up above and the tail bent below underneath the hole of the net to capture that ball that came straight through. Now, the whole butterfly has two antennas sticking out the top of the head, say. Those two were ears that reached up and looped over the rim. So it snapped on the rim, hung freely, circumvented the back of the net, bent underneath the net, and with ball contact, it bottomed out on the mounting plate and recoiled back forward, kicking the ball out towards the court. Now, to test it, I sent them out to, well, I have, first off, I've got neighborhood kids, my torture testers. You know, anything that I develop, I give it to my neighborhood kids, and if they can't bust it, it's a pretty good idea. But normally that doesn't work. Normally they do find a way to bust it. But then you learn. Then you try to correct it. With the ball back, basketball return, when I got to the point where I could really test it and see if it was marketable or of interest, I sent it to basketball camps, high school players. I got some nice letters back. I got a framed letter from Bobby Knight, Digger Phelps, Jim Boeheim. These are all Hall of Fame basketball people who they knew that I understood they weren't my market. I wasn't looking for institutional sales or high school or college sales. I was looking for the interest of players and whether it was a functional tool to increase the free throw percentage and shot percentages. I was a little wrong with that theory. Being a basketball player, I was fascinated with how beneficial it could be to a player. But it ends up that really wasn't my market. Number one, I know I didn't want to tackle the high school and college markets because there you're dealing with an institution that's too bureaucratic. You've got to go through a whole purchasing process and committees and budgeting and all kinds of forms to fill out. And what are you going to do? You walk into a gymnasium, there's two basketball rims. There's one on each end of the court, and there's usually two on a side going up and down. So you got six total. That's not my market. My market was the outdoor court at home. Drive up and down your community and see how many of those plastic-based portable goals are out by the driveway. That's where the market is. Now, I knew it, and how do I prove it? I went onto the Internet, and I looked up. I know that Huffy Manufacturing makes a lot of them. I know that Lifetime is the other. Lifetime probably makes more than Huffy. But between the two of them, they have 34 varieties of that outdoor goal. 34. Now, that doesn't include stationary goals that sit in, have a pole going in the ground, and it doesn't include individual sales of rims that people put on their own backboard or barn side.
really went for the biggest market.
That's, well, I wanted to prove it. I thought that was the biggest market. And, again, having been in the industry and having contacts, I befriended an injection mold shop up north. This was in Iowa. And the injection molder was making wheels for the Huffy Outdoor Goal. Now, that's the only component they manufactured for that unit. But I'm not going to tell anybody this. This is a secret. But I found out from him how many wheels he produced. And I could correlate his wheel production to Huffy's distribution of outdoor goals. And my estimation was they were peddling around 400,000 units a year. Now, this is Huffy. Lifetime is bigger. So it astounded me. I said, this gives me credibility that this is where the market really is.
Sure.
So I went for the whole market, and how true it was when I was at introducing my product, I found out that one of my major customers were grandparents, and they were buying it for the grandkids to play with. They have no idea what basketball is all about. They just know the kids like to shoot hoops. They have no fantasy of the kid ever playing professional basketball by any means. They just want to have a good time and have fun out on the court. And that's where most of them sell. That is the original home market.
Okay.
Now, how I tested that theory was I took the products to Flea Masters, a flea market in Fort Myers, and it's a huge flea market. It's like 700 booths undercover, and they have a cooling system for the, you know, it is quite warm down here in South Florida.
It wasn't last winter.
Well, you know, Ron, I've heard Ron Reardon time and again complain about the heat in Atlanta. Well, you know, the last time I went to Atlanta, I had to buy a sweater. And, you know, I'm a Floridian. You could tell Ron that the first night I had in the motel, I closed all the windows and turned on every faucet in the shower because I like humidity. That's the way it is in Florida. So let's.
Well, you finally then sold the ball back to Walmart then.
Well, eventually, first off, how I got there was I market tested at Flea Masters to the tour. You know, it's a major tourist attraction. When you were a dealer like I was there for 3 years, you kind of prayed for rain. Rain brought the tourists off the beach, off of Sanibel and off of Fort Myers Beach and into the flea market. And they gauged, at that time, there was 10,000 people a weekend that would come through the flea market, and that was accurate. Now, again, from what I've learned then, processing it to today's thought of evolving a product for an inventor, the flea market is great exposure, a great place to introduce the product and talk to customers. Don't tell them you're the inventor. You know, that's not fair. Tell them you're just a marketer and you have a new product and you'd like their opinion of it and whether it's priced correctly and whether they consider buying one, and then give them the pitch. There's no more incentive in this world than selling your product and having somebody put money in your hand. It's the ultimate gesture you want to witness.
Yep.
It gives you tremendous incentive. But on the other hand, you have to be a little tough-skinned because you're going to hear a lot of objections. You're going to hear a lot of comments, a lot of stuff that's negative about it. Well, you want to hear it. You better hear it now in the beginning of the game rather than after you were sitting across the table with a major wheeler dealer and you're trying to promote your product to them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's still too late because they're going to turn it down once. You're not going to get back in and talk to them again. We're at the initial stage, like the flea market, you can keep correcting it and analyzing it and improving it. I got so successful that I was getting other dealers to follow the snowbirds to go north to Michigan, Indiana, and they were marketing my product up there. hardware store owners, merchants, they'd contact me. I just grew and grew and grew little baby steps until I got into some sporting goods chains. Then, when I got kind of credibility and I got some sales and stuff, I snuck into Walmart. Now, this is really something I shouldn't talk about because I was in 7 Walmart supercenters secretively. I was selling to them directly, and I was paying, they were paying me directly, and I was selling them 24 units in a box. And it just grew and grew and grew until the phone rang. And who was it? Bentonville calling.
Wow.
They wanted, oh, this was not a pleasant call. They wanted to know, yeah, they wanted to know what the heck I was doing in their super centers and how I got in there, and I went, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, my answer to them was, I sell a profitable product, and apparently, you know, the managers there like it. They like the profitability of it. They didn't want to hear that. I honestly think I just stepped on too many toes by going in there directly, and they lost control of being the ones that that orchestrated the product going in and could brag about finding it and processing it. And the long and short of it was, they told me I had to buy through the powers at Bentonville. Well, I knew now I was getting a little too big and I was in trouble because I didn't want to abide by their rules and put up with all the bureaucratic baloney that goes with dealing with Walmart. And everyone's heard the horror stories of being a single-item vendor. And I've got 7 products, and I'm still a single-item vendor. And I still suffer all the consequences of that. It's unnerving.
What do you mean by single-item vendor, Tom? Explain that to our listeners.
Well, there's big boys and there's single-item vendors. I've got 7 products. I got all the UPC barcodes. I've got the distribution, fulfillment, sent up, reps. I'm still considered a single-item vendor. You're just not a big enough player. The buyers and the major, let's say Walmart, Kmart, Target, anyone of that size, they don't want to deal with somebody as minuscule as me. You know, a lot of times people will say they want a brand. Well, it isn't the brand. It isn't the label. It isn't the tag they want. What they want is the credibility of the distributor and the fulfillment and the abiding of all the vendor compliance regulations and rules and sequences, and that you're going to be there for years to come. There's a fear of a small supplier not being able to accommodate or satisfy the demand. You know, there's staggering numbers. They're huge numbers. There's no way that my little facility, and I had a couple girls working full-time, opening boxes, putting on labels, putting on the price stickers, doing all kinds of little busy things that the buyer talks you into doing if you want to sell to him. And we were shipping those out as fast as we could handle them. There's no way I could handle the demands of a Walmart. You know, I think inventors sit there and fantasize of reaching that point, but they don't know. You can't handle the capacity. You just can't. Again, like we said earlier, you can't do it all. You certainly can't abide by what a large sales organization like Walmart demands.
That's when you decide to license the Ballback product.
Well, it happened. You know, it happened so comfortably. Here I was in a quandary with them. I didn't want to alienate Walmart. You know, I didn't want to tell them I didn't want to do business with them. But I knew that number one, they didn't want me, and number two, that I would have trouble doing what they expected me to do. And as I'm in this quandary, wondering what I'm going to do, the phone rings, and it was Huffy Sport. And okay. Huffy Sports, for some reason, they're aware that most basketball returns that were my competitors were just in stores gathering dust, and they knew, you know, they're witnessing what's going on. They knew that I was growing and I was selling units. So they came with a gesture that they might want to license it.
And they contacted you. You didn't contact them?
Yeah, they came to me. And, man, I about wet my pants. You know, I was so eager. But, you know, you want to back off a little bit and not let them know that you're already in trouble and looking for someone to bail you out.
Sure.
But we hammered a license agreement that I put in some extra clauses that some of the listeners might appreciate hearing. They were obligated to absorb my existing accounts. I gave up the sporting goods chains that I sold to, Academy Sports, Sports Authority, Jumbo Sports, Hibbett. I literally gave those accounts to Huffy to absorb because I wanted them to do 100% of the fulfillment. I wanted my adventure time back. I didn't want to be doing the mundane invoicing, labeling, shipping. It was exhausting. And I could get back and do more products, come up with more ideas,
sure.
Be more comfortable.
So where's the call back today now, Tom?
Well, it ends up now that I ran that license agreement with Huffy Sport until it was assigned is the proper word. Huffy has multiple divisions. Everyone probably is familiar with their bicycle division. And then they have the Huffy Sports handle the basketball-related items, the accessories. And that was one of the most lucrative divisions. And they were short of funding, so they put it on the market. And Russell Corp bought that from Huffy. Russell is known for warm-up jerseys, fleece outfits, clothing lines. But besides that, they own Spalding, which is the manufacturer of inflatable balls, basketballs and footballs. So we had conversations and meetings, and the legal firms got involved, and we made an assignment, and Russell Corp took over the licensing agreement. And
how did that affect you? Were you involved at the time when that happened, or did it go smoothly?
I was, but I had a marketing, let's say, quasi partner. He didn't have any ownership of the firm, but he was my full time marketer, and I had a contract attorney here in town who, again, it's kind of a specialty to have a legal partnership or a licensing agreement drawn up. You've got to have someone who's much more familiar with it than the guy on the street. You don't want a marriage counselor doing it. So, again, you just got to find the right people to help you do it.
And you really can't do it all, right?
No. It's just too time-consuming. But, again, I was ecstatic over it because I still wanted my free time. And the residuals were coming in monthly. They didn't hurt. But it finally expired when my patent did. We had a contract with Russell that extended beyond the lifetime of the patent. They wanted it so eagerly. And another clause we put in the license agreement was I did give them first refusal on any sport-related items that I was developing.
Mm-hmm.
And they had agreed that they would allow me to put it through their focus groups, and they'd do some evaluation. So this was a win-win for me. If they didn't take the product, I at least got a lot of feedback and knew some faults and failures that I might correct for the next submittal to them or to someone else.
With your patent expiring, tell our listeners what you did with your patent expired, and then what happened.
When the patent expired, all of a sudden our association started deteriorating, and I wasn't sure what was going on. But what the powers at Russell finally decided was that as long as they could get out of my deal, they were going to. So they cited the Supreme Court decision that was kind of in line with our situation, and the long and short of it was that if the patent didn't exist, they weren't obligated, even though in plain English on the contract it stated that the contract extended beyond the life.
All our inventor listeners would be really thrilled to hear you say what happened next, because I know what happened next. But tell our listeners what happened next with your new patent.
Well, you know, when I patented the ball back, this was back obviously 20 years prior. When I patented the original ball back, and had an attorney help me draw up the patent application and the claims, it went through first submittal. Now, you know that 20% is the best record of going through first submittal. 80% of patents are rejected or sent back for amendments or alterations of some type. I was one of the few that went through first time. So here, 20 years later, I wasn't completely ignorant to the fact that my patent was expiring, and I might better be doing something to defeat that situation. So I was developing a new and improved Ballback Pro. And it is bigger, bolder, badder, as I say. And it fits the newest rims, which didn't exist 20 years ago. The new rims that are spring-loaded, breakaway, you see the big boys hanging on them all the time, swinging.
So now are you selling so basically what you're doing now is you're competing against your old product in the shelf.
Well, in a way, but I do still have a market with my old ball back. There are a lot of sporting goods stores that are still interested in having the original ball back, and there's rims out there for it. The new Pro fits all the old rims as well as the new spring-loaded ones, and the Pro has two active patents covering it. They were issued in 2009, and hold me down, you can't believe this, it went through the first submittal. Now I'm really flabbergasted, you know. here I am writing enough claims. You know the rules of a utility patent. It has to provide a function. It has to be unique. Well, I was filing a patent on a product that really and truly already existed, but I thought of enough uniqueness and design—not design changes, but function changes—and enough that went through the first submittal.
Wow!
So now I've got 20 years coverage of that. I was so impressed, I filed for a design patent as well, and that went through.
Oh, that's great.
So now,
if you think about all the success you've had and everything, and I know you've written a book called Inventor in Paradise, what kind of advice would you give to others?
Well, the first thing we talked about was when I was in trouble shooting hoops, I wanted the ball to come back to me. And I started thinking about something simplistic and at home, as I say, right underneath my nose. The first thing I tell the inventors when I'm offering any measuring device is, you know, I like to say, don't try to think of a cure to cancer. You know, we aren't that smart. Try to think of something simplistic that you know about, that you can build, and you can make money on, and then we can donate to a charitable organization for the cure of cancer, you know. Don't try to do that.
Sure.
You've got to stay... Keep her closer to the ground. Stay at home. Simple things are better for me. I love single-piece products. You've got to search your product. You know, before you go flying off on a tangent and doing a whole lot of work, you might better do some market research and product evaluation. Find out that you have a market. Find out that there's numbers out there. There's always a market. You can give things away, but aren't we in it for profit? So you've got to know what your price point is and if the people will support it. Then, Then once you know that you have a product and you have a price point and you have a way to make profit, now go to your factory. Find a friendly factory. I don't care what you got to pay for those first prototypes and that first initial run. Pay for it whatever you have to. You are not, when you're at that stage of the game, profit is not your motivation. Your motivation is product introduction. You want to get it out in the marketplace. You want to prove there's a need, want, and desire for it, that it's useful. When you get into the big numbers, you will discover all the alterations and benefits of going into mass production. And you can get your unit costs down then. And believe me, the big boys, when you sit across the table from them and you show them your product and you're telling them it costs you $3 and you're selling it for $15, well, you know what's going through their mind? They've got offshore connections of their own. They've got partnerships, and they know that if you're making it for $3, they're going to make it for $2.50 or $2.25. They know they've got contacts that we don't even know exist.
Sure. Well, Ron, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think this has been a really fascinating story. And, Tom, we really appreciate you being on the show. But if people want to learn more about Ballback and get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Well, they can always go to ballbackinc.com or Ballback, you know, is B-A-L-L-B-A-C-K-I-N-C, Ballback Inc. Or go to me directly, theinventorinparadise.com.
Okay.
I have a blog and a lot of, I got about 32 videos on there that are 2 minutes or so long, each one instructive, introducing prices and ways to get patents and how to file a provisional and useful topics for the novice or not just the novice inventor, but entrepreneurs in general would benefit from it.
Okay, well, thanks for being on our show today, Tom. Our listeners really appreciate you sharing your experiences and insights. It's really been super. Thanks.
Well, you're welcome, Ron. It's been a pleasure being here, and keep up the good work. I love your program.
All right, well, super. Well, it's another great show, Bill.
It sure was, Ron, and I really appreciate Tom being on and telling us about all his successes as an inventor. I also want to thank our today's sponsor, Patents and More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And go to our blog, thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com, to listen again to today's show, plus all the previous shows. This is Ron Reardon and Bill McHenry, signing off another great session of The Launch Hour.